Like,
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Welcome, welcome, world's worst monster podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me take a sip of coffee.
Yeah.
192. Another daytime. Daytime podcast. That's why I'm drinking coffee, because there's no reason why I'd be drinking coffee at 11 o'clock at night.
Well, it's like drooling. It's strange. Daytime rolling.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Been a minute since that. Oof.
I've only heard that it's a really strange experience.
I remember. Well, daytime, lots of activities certainly is.
We certainly did plenty of damage to our livers during the day.
God, yeah. Ugh. I just had all sorts of flashbacks, but good night.
Well, I mean, I was talking to Sierra the other day about the fact that Army and Navy officers and enlisted alike, when both 5 Center and 5 East refer to that house that we lived in Rockville, that Sierra and Peterson and I, Kim and I lived in Rockville, as the frat house. And it really, not that it was really a lot cooler to frat, obviously. Me and frat boys haven't always got along. And by always, I mean never. But it really did epitomize, in a lot of ways, think about it, it was the site of a lot of the first crossover.
I was going to say there were a lot of those.
Yeah, a lot of those too. But it was a lot of crossover hangouts between Army and Navy that heretofore didn't exist.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, so it really, you know, be a thing. Because if you remember Christmas 2011, and people are going to see this in this book that I'm finally releasing in December. But if you remember Christmas 2011, there were no... not extensive anyway. If it happened, it was very isolated, but there was no real Army and Navy hanging out that went on. I mean, we talked.
Yeah. There was, I mean,
fast forward to Christmas 2012 and, you know, like the club Citron night. I mean, everybody was going out together, spending time together. It is what a difference a year made.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a lot of joint operations that were going on, but there certainly weren't a lot of joint service medals being handed out, even for the last 15 years. So it was pretty cool. I mean, it definitely, look, here's my immediate supervisor structure throughout from 2010 through, well, we'll just say 2013. It literally went civilian, GS worker was my first raider, right? My senior raider. Immediate raider. Then my second boss was a lieutenant commander in the Navy. So my first two commands, well, you actually have an Army command, but your supervisor, your immediate supervisor was...
You have a detachment, of course.
Yeah, of course. But my boss, the person that I reported to on day-to-day operations, first was a GS civilian and then a lieutenant commander in the Navy. So it wasn't until my third duty station, so Walter Reed, San Antonio for the better part, did I finally have an Army major, or, you know, captain for that matter, who was finally my frontline supervisor. So, I mean, it's been an interesting ride. And
that's a mirror of me. It's weird that except for Chief Arnold, who was certainly a very visible presence my second year in Bethesda, I primarily had Army, you know, from medevac. Yeah. On back up to 5 Center, I mean, it was cool. And I remember at the time, some folks were like, man, you get along with the Army and all this. I'm going, well, okay. First of all, we both served the same flag.
same team, right?
My father was in the Army. So I don't know what you want me to whose side I'm supposed to pick here.
I just happened to get to that recruiter first.
I mean, dude, well, yeah, exactly. That's the real, I had left messages with both. I wanted to be either a medic or a corpsman. And the Army called me second.
Yep.
Yeah. The rest is history. You know, but I got a lot of, I'm sure you remember some of it, but I got a lot of stink from especially fellow corpsmen for, you know, they would see me talking to you or Al. You know, I remember one time you were coming down the hallway and Alan, she was like, oh, your best friend's coming. And it wasn't because it was you. It was because it was somebody in green.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's funny.
Well, it's funny. It's in the collusion. Past. Almost collusion. And it's, I just remember, I was trying to tell someone this. I met up. Who was it? I think maybe it was some patients or patient family members that had spent some time in the Navy. And of course, you know, you get to talking about that kind of stuff. And I didn't really have much to say about the Navy other than the individuals who I had met. But I said, you know what? Actually, I'll tell you the truth. I remember working with the Navy, and probably the first month, it was right around, well, it was a couple of months in, it was around Christmas time, and the Master Chief was walking through the facility. And it always threw us off because when we would drive into this, again, hospital on fixed, on land, they would say, welcome aboard. Which, that was just the funny, that was just had to get used to, like, all right, I guess I'm coming aboard this hospital that's fully cemented into the
deck
ground.
Instead of the floor.
Yeah, fifth deck, the galley instead of the cafeteria, or the DFAC, as we would call it. Anyway, I remember the Master Chief was roaming through the hallways. It was a night shift, and he was getting ready to leave. And he comes up to the nurse's station, and typically as the charge nurse, you don't have to, as the officer, you didn't have to stand up for the Master Chief, but you've been around for a minute, so you get up and, hey, Master Chief, how are you? And he grabbed one of the corpsmen, in a medic, army medic, and he said, what's with all this gear adrift in the P-way? And the corpsman knew exactly what the hell he was talking about. And the poor...
He's talking about the mess in the hallway.
Yeah, he's talking about what's all the equipment doing in the hallway. So what you say is, what's all the gear adrift in the P-way? The unsecured equipment in the hallway.
I'm sure the medic was going,
dude,
what?
That poor enlisted medic was like, I legitimately... This is... The Master Chief, for those of you who don't, is the senior enlisted, right? I'm right. The senior enlisted.
Yeah, he's an E9.
Yeah, the senior enlisted corpsman or enlisted guy on post. So the top dog next to the admiral. And that poor, like, E3 specialist medic had no idea. Had no idea what he was talking about, had no idea how to react, had no idea what action he should carry, because he wasn't about to question the Master Chief either. So it was just, and quite frankly, I wasn't laughing because I also had no idea what the hell he was talking about either, but at least I could say, Master Chief, I actually don't respectfully, like, have no idea what you're talking about. So anyway, that was my cool. Yeah, he was a really nice guy. So
he's one I had to go back to his office, because in our career counselings we all just, you know, turn in whatever, and there was a spot on, like, some sort of question, the effect of what you saw yourself being as a lifetime goal. And obviously now, for somebody determined to never run for office, this is ironic, but I had put to be Speaker of the U.S. House, and they thought I was being funny, and they wanted me to know they didn't consider it funny. And so I had to go in and explain myself, you know, going, no, Master Chief, I promise you, I wasn't being snarky. But they gave me a little bit of an analysis for that. We'll put it that way.
Really?
So, well, they thought I was being smart. You know, I'm going, no, this really, this is what I want
to
do.
I guess at the time it was Boehner, who's you definitely look up to. So,
right. I really looked up to him. You know, a lot's changed in the last five, six years, obviously.
Indeed.
Well, DC and my personal life. But anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, without swapping too many more war stories, I wanted to talk about a different kind of war story, and that is trade war story. So we haven't really talked about tariffs, and there's definitely a lot of macro econ that goes into it, and certainly I'm learning more about that, and you know quite a bit about it, and I think it's quite interesting. But what has made me more interested in the trade war which were not really defined as a trade war, but the trade scuffles, if you will, going between China and the United States, is the addition of a potential trade escalation or trade issue with Mexico. And the difference between China, and I think we can establish some things fairly quickly. I think it's a lot harder, personally, and you're more than welcome to chime in here. I think it's a lot harder to be against any sort of tariff or any sort of trade scuffle with China, because China does actually do devious shit. They do manipulate their currency. This isn't wrong, but there's a lot of state interest in industry there. And
when they do insist that to do trade in the country, the price of admission is any intellectual properties you
exactly.
have.
Exactly. So, and we'll get into some of this. But yes, the other piece of that is...
Right, good point. It's much more... You have to be much more nuanced in your opposition to this, because the Trump administration is certainly right in one thing, and that's in doing what Bush and Obama didn't do.
Exactly.
And what Romney said he would do, I don't believe he would have. Yeah. So then Trump actually has a just cause here.
Yeah, and he absolutely does. The problem is, I don't care if you're Obama, I don't care if you're Clinton, I don't care if you're Bush, I don't care if you're Trump, there's going to be sacrifices in order to possibly get China to sway. Look, there's a couple problems with this, whether it's justified or not, and I think it is. There's a couple things, and I'll let you chime in here, and I'll just get these out. The first thing is, China plays a long game. They can play a long game. That's just the way it goes. The Communist Party, Xi Jinping, consolidating power, all they have to do is wait 4 years. Or maybe they just have to wait 8 years until Trump is out of office. Every 2 years, we have elections. There's a long game that they can play, and if that means there's a bit of a trade scuffle for a couple years, they're able to outlive that, because their policies are far more long-term than the United States. The second thing, intellectual property. The more and more I think about intellectual property, although a justification for Trump to enact tariffs on China, the other thing I have to say with that is, look, man, that's the price of doing business in China. I don't care if you're a multinational company. I don't care if you're an entrepreneur. If that's the market you choose to dive into, that's the price you pay to do business. There's plenty of other places to go to. Look, I realize that China's got 1.1 billion people, that they're trying to merge the rural in with the urban environment, and there's a lot of jobs to be made. There's a lot of technology. There's a lot of innovation that China's not creating, but they're certainly harnessing from other companies and taking their intellectual property. There's a lot of opportunity there, but it's the price of doing business. And is it the government's role to step in and try to protect American business there in terms of IP? I don't know. The more I think about it, the more I say, is it worth the outcome? Is it worth the long term? Well, in our case, it'd be long term, 4 to 8 years, but is it worth it? Because in the end, Trump's going to go away. It's going to be he's going to go away at some point. His administration's going to go away at some point, and someone else is going to step in, and they've got to decide whether or not they want to continue with tariffs. Because at the end of the day, China does suffer a little bit, but you know who else suffers? The consumer suffers. And if I'm not mistaken, what's the biggest chunk of GDP, right? It's not net import. It's not net exports. It's not government spending. It's consumers. It's consumption. And if you push down aggregate demand, I mean, that's not really great for GDP. I don't know how much demand would be stifled by, or supply be stifled by, overall tariffs with China, but or long-term tariffs, but I can't imagine 25% would be great over the long term. Anyway, I'll shut up. Thoughts?
No. It wouldn't be. No, you're fine. I a lot of this is speculative simply because of the nature of we don't know. What's going to happen? Are they just counting down the clock towards November 2020 in the hopes that somebody else gets elected? I'm not sure. But I do know that there is a way, there are ways to long-term affect China here. And I mentioned one to you in precast that I really think is worth looking at, not the Trans-Pacific Partnership specifically, because I don't think it went far enough, but a sort of pan-Asian union of sorts that we could easily... No, well, not easily. It would have to be drawn up. But there's plenty of countries out there, specifically India, that want to foray further into the modern world, that that's a country with over 1 billion people and a very diverse market. There are plenty of ways, though, in building such a Pan-Asian Union that we could create a trade environment that practically globally is hostile to China and Russia both.
Yeah.
That would be, you know, if you had Korea, Japan, both Koreas, Japan, Vietnam, India, Australia, Singapore, Qatar, Dubai, United Arab Emirates, you know, you had a lot of economic allies in a union saying, look, China, if you want to play ball globally, period, then this behavior is no longer going to be tolerated.
Yeah, and here's...
You shouldn't be in isolation like you were before Richard Nixon.
And you gotta act fast, because China's Silk Road policy that they're trying to enact across Asia and into Africa makes a lot of those countries indebted to China. And you gotta... I think that's the problem that we were faced with.
Well, yeah, a lot of people have gotten into bed with China.
And that's because they really, in order for there to be some sort of innovation in third world countries, and not necessarily just third world countries, but China's coming in with a huge infrastructure push. And I said, look, man, we're going to build you a 5-lane highway right smack dab through here. We're going to right to the ports, right? And it doesn't do anything for those countries necessarily, but it's getting done. And I mean, in terms of labor, in terms of developing the economy, but it's getting done. And they're not going to do that in Korea. They're not going to do that in Vietnam. They're not going to do that in Japan, but they're sure as hell going to do it from China all the way to Africa.
Yeah, they've done it for Ethiopia.
Exactly. So I guess my point is, I see there could be value in that.
To me, that's the only long-term way outside of a military solution.
So look, the other long-term issue with the sort of a trans-Asian partnership is that you have a lot of companies that have a lot of supply chain, a lot of third-party manufacturing done in China, and it will be a long-term process to move that capital across borders. You know, China's, I think what's interesting, has moved from a fairly unskilled labor market to a fairly skilled labor market, whereas they've sort of offset things like textiles, et cetera, to places like Vietnam and Bangladesh. That's why if you open up your pair of jeans, it'll say made in Vietnam, not made in China. So they have a fairly skilled labor force. So you also have to work on that development in some of those other countries. Probably not India, but India comes with its own set of issues in terms of like the gridlocks and bureaucracy of democracy, in terms of where China doesn't have that issue, right? So when you have one nation, one state, one vision, it's a lot easier to get banks to lend to you. It's a lot easier to get projects started, and it's a lot easier to fund projects that have clear diminishing returns, where you might not have that same thing in China or in India. So you have to get started now, because you have to move that capital from China into these other countries, and you have to get that labor force more skilled. So I don't know. I mean, I see your point. I think that is a way to squeeze them in the long term, because I don't think tariffs do anything in the long term in terms of 20 years, 15 years, 10 years. That China will, they could concede now, and say, yeah, okay, fine. Well, what do y'all want, right? And then 8 years from now, just go back to the way they want, right? I mean, like, I just don't think I'm...
That's the thing. That's hence my idea for a Pan-Asian Union or a Trans-Asian Union, because that's a long-term framework, you know, combined with the fact that as much as they would like for it to, the Chinese Navy still does not hold a candle to ours, and we have the capability to interject in the high seas, which is where 90% of trade still occurs, and our allies are crying out for us to do so. Whether we like it or not, Japan and Australia specifically don't want us going anywhere, okay? Because China has become a terrific menace there. They've actually test-fired missiles over the Isle of Japan. So there's a real desire for us to do it, and there's a real vacuum for us to do it in. It's a new variant of Cold War in reality, because Russia didn't have the capability to respond economically to us. China is still communist, but at the same time, they did embrace capitalist reforms. Okay, that's it. But outside of the big cities, the megalopolis, it's as backwater as a lot of their peers. Okay, yeah. So the reality is there. We took trade away from Japan. We took trade away from Taiwan. You know, we haven't invested as thoroughly in India as we wanted to, and it could also be a backhanded solution to some woes in the Middle East as well, with partnerships. So there's a lot of opportunities here. It's not going to be as simple as levying tariffs and mm-hmm. winning a trade war, because this is a multifaceted sort of variation on the Cold War.
So here's a. We didn't talk about this in precast, so I'm gonna ask you a hypothetical. There's something that hasn't happened in China for quite a while, and it has happened to us twice in the last 19 years, and that's a recession. So 2001, we had a recession for 11 months, and then we had like an 18-month-long recession known as the Great Recession, with roughly a 9-year slow growth economy. Funny enough, none of that shit happened in China, and they've been fairly absolved of any sort of recession over the last, you know, decade plus. How would a potential recession play into us with the vice grip on China and getting what we want? And, you know, just set the stage. I mean, there's a potential housing crisis in China. I mean, they are pushing on infrastructure. They're able to lend without those debts being really paid, because when you do projects with diminishing returns, especially things like railroads, etc., there's no way to pay those debts back. And then you have a crisis.
They have a mid to longer term future crisis looming as well, that they've only just now realized, oh shit, what did we do? And that was via the state's one child policy. Mm-hmm. They have exponential millions. It's unlike, you know, most hospitals, they report having more female births, right? That's in general. Well, China has the inverse problem. They have millions more males coming of age now, because it was preferable in those one child households to have a male. So there's more going on here, but also notice that China is no longer, if they did have those 10% GDP quotas to begin with, which is outstanding if they did, but the data has clearly not drifted into recession by any means, because they're still expanding.
But it's slow. But
it's far slower than it has been. They've taken on far more debt than they had previously, and they're starting to, I think, see some of the limitations as far as what they're able to pull off in the South China Sea. You know, they may have expressed displeasure with the Secretary of State meeting with Taiwan, you know, but they didn't do a damn thing about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they didn't even threaten to.
Yeah.
So they like it or not, they can resent it all they want, but they still realize at the end of the day that unless they want out-and-out warfare, a war they couldn't win, then, I mean, that's going to be a war that nobody wins in reality. But there's no positive outcome to be gained there. Unless they want that, then at the end of the day, they have to kiss the ring, if you will.
Yeah.
And so that's where we have to realize we've got an opportunity here to do something that the current administration is not terribly fond of, and that is geopolitically lead. You know, the Trans-Asian Partnership that I throw out there, the Pan-Pacific, whatever you want to call it, that's going to take leadership, but it's a vacuum that, as I mentioned before, other countries really want us to fill.
Yeah, and maybe that's the nail on the head right there, that it is really geopolitically that it's time to step up and lead. And if you're imposing these 25%, potential 25% tariffs on all Chinese goods, that you now step up and say, listen, while we're doing this, we're strengthening all of our friendships in the Asian region, on top of the Pacific region, and you take steps there. I mean, I think that's a fantastic idea. Is it complicated? Hell yeah, it's complicated.
But there's no way to be geopolitically solvent while dictating things from a position of isolation. That's why, you know, the Crown Emperor of Japan, I don't know if you heard about this, but the Crown Emperor of Japan and the Prime Minister in the throne room, it has never in their 1,200 year plus history been allowed for anybody to sit in the chair, whether it was the emperor on down, and I'm going somewhere with this, the emperor on down to any cadre of staff sat cross-legged on the floor. The president of the United States, Donald John Trump, first person in recorded history to sit in a chair in that room. Now, if it was me, I would have gone, okay, I feel a little tacky here. By a little, I mean a lot. No such qualms for our president, but that ought to speak volumes about the significance with which they see our relationship. And this is a country, the only country that has had nuclear bombs dropped on it by us, no less. And that's how far they're willing to go to kiss the ring. So we can't have it both ways. As much as Trump and his populist base really want that, they want isolationism for the most part. They contradict themselves, obviously, with the state of Israel. Well, that's not isolationism, folks.
Nope.
They pick and choose. Well, in this case, we're not going to be able to assert our dominance, flex our naval muscle, flex our economic muscle, and win any sort of variation on the with any sort of variation on the old Cold War playbook like we use for Russia. We're not going to be able to do it and sit behind our walls. We've got to get out there. I mean, that's like saying that I want to get out in the dating world and meet the long-lost bleached blonde beach bunny I want in California, but I'm not willing to leave my house.
Yeah.
Well, then you have a problem, Jonathan.
Indeed.
We had this. I know that's a very simplified version.
No, but it's true.
It's the reality.
Sure.
So I think there's a lot of potential to do it. I'm not sure if the president is willing to do that. He seems willing to engage Japan for sure. What it will be interesting to see, should he stick around, should he win re-election, because even the hawks in his administration, Bolton and Pompeo, they realize we can't do this in a vacuum. We can't have peace in the Middle East. We can't maintain the stability of Israel in a vacuum. They know that.
Yeah. Well, so, and let's also be clear. The president is not a populist. The president is not an isolationist. That's his administration has crafted him to be that person. He's an international, like he's a multinational, not corporation, but company.
He picks, though.
What's that?
They're people that he picked.
Oh, exactly. But they sounded good to him. I remember it wasn't too long ago that Trump said, well, I guess I'm a populist. National populist. Yeah, I guess that's what I am. Like, he just learned what that was. So, meaning I think that when Trump goes to places like Japan.
So then you grant there being, so I just got to ask you this. So then you would grant even greater possibility of this happening then?
I do. Yeah. Like, I think. Let's pretend the president has another 5 years in office.
Which, yeah, let's say he wins re-election.
Yeah, because he probably is. So as of right now, I think that if somehow the message got out to him or somehow he had a light bulb go off, I think he would see the value in it. The guy's a businessman, right? And quite frankly, he's not the civic – he's not the public – lifetime public servant and diplomat that I'm not saying he doesn't care about the country, but he doesn't have that connection to patriotism, the love for the country that maybe a civil service officer would have for his entire career. Or, you know, I don't know what's in the president's heart, but
look, the man hasn't served anybody but himself his entire life.
I guess that's my point. However, I think he would see the value in partnership, even if it's beyond what's best for the United States, but what's good for business later on. I mean,
well, and it could be argued. Maybe I need to write him a letter. Maybe he doesn't have this adult in the room with him. Okay, but I would argue that our friendship, while we were still in the military, and the varying friends we had there in Rockville, yeah, we had to go outside of the confines of our own homes to get it. But it made each of us individually stronger. Well, there's a strong argument to be made that with the idea of such a pan or trans-Asian union, okay, the United States is not only uniquely, qualified to lead here, and not only will the bulk of our allies follow, but it would be good for America. That's how I would frame it if I was one of his advisors. I'd be like, sir, you're looking at this all wrong if you think that this is about Australia, Japan, India et al. This is about America and American access to foreign markets, American long-term security in the face of a potential foe that makes Soviet Russia look like a kindergarten.
Yeah.
To me, that's a winning argument here. Now, I'm obviously not in that room, and people would say, man, it's a good thing.
Well, but you've got John Bolton and Stephen Miller in that room. That's the situation that's going on. And they're not.
Mr. Bolton, I think he's a bright mind. I know he's a hardliner. I don't really have a whole lot of respect for Stephen Miller.
I don't at all.
Being real.
Yeah. So, anyway, hey, look, we're at 30 minutes. I think this is a good conversation, and I think I enjoy talking econ with you and monetary fiscal policy. So more to be followed on that. But anyway, yeah, so a little tariff talk, and I think China, we didn't get to Mexico, and I think maybe we can do that later at another podcast.
We'll see if it actually happens.
Yeah, but we will see if there's a potential tariff on Mexico for immigration. But I think as that matures, we'll talk about that more. So
that's an interesting word choice.
Yeah. So, well, as always, my friend, it's an honor and privilege to do this with you. So until next time,
au revoir.
We'll see you.